Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl, have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Creative control, creative control. Comedy, art, and sometimes rock and roll. Let's do a public opinion poll. Raise your hand if you love creative control. 'Cause when Vish is unleashed, well, you... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I was just working on a tribute song to my favorite podcast, Creative Control, with Vish Khanna. My name is Matthias, and I play in a band called The Burning Hell, but more importantly, I support Creative Control on Patreon, and I think you should too. Quality long-form arts journalism is like a magical talking unicorn. It definitely exists, but it can be really hard to find. Fortunately for us, Vish makes it easy with hundreds of funny, thought-provoking, well-researched and engaging interviews with artists from all over the world. Your flexible monthly donation on Patreon will get you plenty of special exclusive treats and help Vish keep his podcast well-fed and cared for properly, the way a magical unicorn deserves.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Dan Bechner is a talented songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, singer, podcaster, and producer who's currently based in New Orleans, Louisiana. Originally from British Columbia, Canada, Bechner is well-respected for his founding role in the band Wolf Parade and for branching out in other collaborations, including Handsome Furs, Operators, and Divine Fits. Since 2021, he has co-hosted the Canadian politics podcast The Bottleman with Riley Quinn, and in 2022, he became a full-time member of Arcade Fire. On March 15th, 2024, Sub Pop released his first solo album, which is self-titled, where the project and the record are both called Beckner. To help celebrate this new chapter, Dan returns to this show for an expansive and dynamic conversation about things like living in New Orleans and why any Canadian snobbery he may have had about America has vanished in recent years. These sordid but lesser-known aspects of Canadian politics and history and this country's tacit and overt support and importation of fascist elements over the past 100 years, feckless Canadian journalism and some of its more questionable figures, Israel, Palestine, and perceptions of the war crimes in Gaza, how aspects of the pandemic and human behavior influence the lyrics on his otherwise upbeat and powerful new album, collaborating with people like Matt Chamberlain, Brad Lehner, and Kiwi Junior's Jeremy Gaudet, answering a question from one of my Patreon subscribers, upcoming tour dates, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and tell all your friends all about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary and most reliable way for podcasters like me to make a living. And boy, do I need it now, I'll tell you that. Again, if you can support the show on Patreon, it really does mean the world. I don't know how else to put it. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with bricks and mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and a great website, blackbird.ca, where you can order records and they'll ship them right to your house if they can get them for you. Say you want the new album Beckner by Beckner, go to blackbird.ca, type it in, see if you can't get it. I'm sure you can. Plus, in-kind support from independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 846 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Dan Beckner, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
Yellow-minded sea glass, washed up on a perilous shore, burning in the hot sun, melted down right to the core. I wanna tell you, shut down, I wanna be a universal circuit breaker. I know you're tired of this town, when the only thing that grows is shadow, shadow.
Hey Dan, how's it going?
I'm good.
Good. It's nice to see you again. Where in the world are you?
I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Nice. What brings you to New Orleans? I wasn't expecting you to say that. I thought you'd say Montreal or something like that.
No, I moved to New Orleans last April. Yeah. So I've been living down here for almost a year, I guess, which is crazy to think about. And I love it down here.
What drew you to New Orleans specifically, though? I'm just curious. I've never been. I've always wanted to go.
Well, I started coming down here when I joined Arcade Fire, and I really fell in love with it. So,
yeah. Is the weather weird? Every time there's like a bad thing with the weather in America, with the hurricanes and that, they're like, "Uh-oh, New Orleans," and I'm like, "Oh boy, that sounds bad."
No, so I think Texas and California have been getting the brunt of whatever this latest like weather convulsion is. But it just rained like crazy here for the last couple of days, and now it's hot and sunny, and it's like a tropical climate down here. So everything is just blooming and growing. Hmm. It's like spring basically overnight. It's really nice.
I can't recall. Have you ever spent time living in the States? You're Canadian. For those who don't know, Dan, you're Canadian.
I am Canadian. Yeah. I lived in California for several years, between 2011, 2012 to 2016, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you like living in America as a Canadian? Do you have perspective on it? Do you feel,
Fish. I used to have a kind of a Canadian superiority complex, the sort of Canadian liberal, like, at least we're not America.
Yeah.
But as time goes on, not much difference.
No.
I mean, there are different contours of shittiness in America that don't exist in Canada, but there are also contours of shittiness in Canada that don't exist in America. For instance, the total inflation of the and like kind of capture of the housing market in Canada. It's similar down here, but it's not quite as like all consuming. You can still buy a house for not a reasonable amount of money by any stretch of the imagination, but like, you know, you're not paying $1.5 million for a fucking one bedroom in Nanaimo, for instance.
Right. Here. Right. Right.
Like, you can move away from sort of the imperial core and still find places that are cheap.
So was it work or was it that? Just like the fact that it's somehow more affordable to live in the States than Canada?
I think it's both. Yeah. And, you know, just needed a change.
Okay. So, well, yeah. It's good to see you. And I wasn't expecting this. And I, you know, now that I know someone in New Orleans, gives me an opportunity to visit maybe. I don't know. I don't want to impose.
Come on down anytime. Anytime.
Hey, you know, before we started rolling, we were talking about the podcast you used to have or still have. Sorry, let's get to that right away. Is it something that might come back?
I think so. Yeah, I'm it might not come back. And so I had a podcast for a couple of years with my good friend Riley, who is a Canadian from Niagara-on-the-Lake, but lives in the UK. He has a very popular podcast in Britain called Trash Future. And he reached out to me during the pandemic and was like, I think he knew me from Twitter, and he, you know, we met on Twitter, but he was like, we got to do a show about Canada and Canadian politics. Hmm. So we started The Bottleman, and I'm really proud of that podcast, actually. Like, I don't know if it'll come back as The Bottleman, but I am gearing up to do another podcast like that, if not under the same moniker.
Okay. And so you say you're proud of it. What are you particularly proud of in terms of what you covered?
I think the thing that I'm most proud of is that our research and constant publicization of the monument to the victims of communism helped get it shut down, which made me very, very happy. I mean, and I will say the thing that finally got the monument shut down is that, you know, the prime minister and the fucking deputy prime minister invited a literal SS officer to parliament when Zelensky visited and then gave him a fucking standing ovation.
Right.
I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Now, wait a minute. Was your podcast still going during that incident?
No, it was not. But, you know, several years before that, we did a lot of episodes about the importation of Ukrainian fascists into Canada. Specifically, you're in Edmonton, right?
I am in Edmonton these days, yeah.
Yeah. So Edmonton being the kind of epicenter of that. There is in Edmonton a Ukrainian youth center that has a statue of a man named Roman Shukievich, who headed up something called the Nachtigall Battalion, which was a German SS battalion, which is just as bad as you think.
Wow.
From it, the way it is. Shukievich, you know, personally presided over the liquidation of about 30,000 Jews and Poles in Western Ukraine.
Huh.
So I started digging into this story like well before the podcast started. I had no idea that Canada had this. What I thought at first was an open door policy, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized it was a calculated move on the part of the Mackenzie King government to basically cool out leftist, late pro-labor sentiment with the existing Ukrainian diaspora in the West. So,
wow. Huh.
So the first wave of Ukrainians that came over were used as sort of human fuel to tame the prairies in the West, the agriculture jobs, and used as settlers, really. And a lot of those people, like in the 1890s, would have been fleeing Tsarist pogroms and, you know, the cyclical waves of famine that moved through that part of the Russian Empire. And when they arrived in Canada, they formed very close-knit social groups. And then as the Bolshevik Revolution, I mean, and this is just kind of a crash surface history of it. You can read a lot more about it. You know, Jean-Paul Himka is a really great writer on this. But yeah, so their diaspora kind of coalesced around, we're very influenced by the Bolshevik Revolution in the beginning of the last century. And they started forming labor workers' benevolent unions, so labor temples.
Yeah.
And these labor temples offered a proto version of healthcare. So you had a very like leftist, openly communist in some groups, Ukrainian diaspora who were extremely strong and extremely politically organized. And that, after the Second World War ended, really upset the Canadian government.
Hmm.
And one way they felt like they could sort of deal with this problem was to take these displaced persons. I mean, our deputy prime minister's grandfather is one of these people. So,
I see.
Christia Freeland. So her grandfather, Michael Chomiak, or Mihailo Chomiak, was the editor of a newspaper called Krakovsky Vishti, which was the biggest Ukrainian language newspaper on the planet during the Second World War, and was also the main propaganda organ for the Nazis on the Eastern Front.
Wow.
So Krakovsky Vishti would have articles like How to Recognize a Jew in Your Neighborhood, and also recruitment ads for something called the SS 14th, which a lot of Ukrainian nationalists joined.
Yeah, there's, first of all, that's all very fascinating. I don't know enough about some of the stuff you're talking about to speak too intelligently, but that sounds really fascinating. I will say, and I don't think Canadians really ponder this too much, during the Second World War, most of Canadian media was very supportive of Hitler.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mackenzie King himself, we did also in Bottleman, we did an episode on Mackenzie King, specifically his obsession with seances.
Hmm.
He had a medium that he used to go visit in Detroit who he would use to speak to his dead mother. But the really interesting thing about King is when he goes to Berlin at the beginning of the 1930s, as the Nazis have taken power, this is after the Reichstag fire. And you can read in his diary this sort of slavish adoration he had for Hitler's national program and Hitler himself.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy just fucking loved Hitler.
Yeah, and so you would see at the time, I wasn't there obviously, well before my time, but if you picked up the Globe and Mail or listened to CBC or whatever, there would be pro-Hitler and Nazi editorials just being like, this is good. What's happening in Europe is great. And then I think some of that sentiment, at least, well, I'd say all of that sentiment is spilling over into, I think, what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I could go on forever about this, but I'd encourage people to listen to some of the episodes of Bottleman where we talk about the diaspora in depth. We've got a lot of guests that come on and talk about their experiences as Ukrainians. My friend Yasha Levine, who's a Ukrainian Jew, you know.
Yeah.
So essentially you had, like you were saying, a government that was very pro what was happening in Germany.
Yeah.
Then you have the Second World War part of it where, you know, we were, I mean, in these people's minds, we were forced to ally ourselves with Stalinist Russia, right?
Right.
The Russians, you know, there's no real question who defeated the Nazis. It was the Red Army, you know,
right,
and they
right.
cost them 23 million people.
Right.
Right. But they did it. After the war was over, back to business as usual, which was anti-communism, smash the labor movement. And I guess, you know, we should probably talk about the record, but the last thing I will talk about, one of the things I was proud of covering on the podcast is in the early 1950s, Inco, the nickel plant in Ontario, Inco had a huge labor action. They had a massive strike. There was labor unrest brewing at the plant. And a lot of this stuff, like, you can't find it on the internet. You've got to go to, like, newspapers.com and actually read, you know, journalism from the era. Inco basically whined and complained to the RCMP, who then imported Hungarian fascists. Guys who used to be part of the Arrow Cross Party who would have fought in the Hungarian version of the SS and sort of seeded the plant with these like unreconstructed Hungarian fascists. Unfortunately for the Hungarians, some of the guys in the Union had fought in the Second World War and recognized their tattoos.
Hmm.
So they had, you know, either Nazi tattoos or Arrow Cross tattoos. So the labor union just, you know, they basically beat the shit out of these guys. And the idea was, this whole all got uncovered in the 90s, but the idea was that, not unlike with the Ukrainian diaspora, you could use fascists to discipline labor, you know?
Yeah.
You just put them in there and you use them to threaten and intimidate and beat and spy on people, you know, spy on the union. But it didn't work, so...
I want to ask you two follow-ups, and then we will talk about your brilliant new record that we all love in my house. I'll tell you this. My son today, who's really into hip-hop now, he's almost disavowed the rock music. I was playing this in the car as I was driving him to school today, and his friend, you know, it's like minus 30 here this morning, I will tell you that. Sometimes we walk and sometimes we drive. But I drove, and he's been hearing your record, and he said, is this out yet? Because if I say yes, he'll add it to his machine, his phone. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, it's out on, it's not out yet. It's out March 15th. He's like, oh. I was like, why, do you like it? He's like, yeah, I like this one. It's good. So 12-year-olds.
I wonder why.
I think, you know what else I'll say about it? And then we'll get into it. But I want to, don't let me lose track of what we were just talking about. Because I want to ask you two things about it. But I said to my wife after I dropped my kids off, my wife and I were listening to it, and she's also been hearing it a bunch of times, and I said, you know, there's some Springsteen in here. And she said, what? I don't hear any Springsteen. What are you talking about? I'm like, I don't know. The first two songs, good Lord. And then a moment after I said it, a saxophone peeled out. She's like, oh, I see. And then, but what her view of it was, it's too like indie rock. She said, oh, like if Bruce like made it like an indie rock record or something. And I said, no, there's something there. There's something about the choruses and pre-choruses and the impassioned. You know what? I'm just going to dig into it now. We'll go back to what I said. I'm not going to forget. Are you even are you a Bruce person at all, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I always have been.
Okay, just making sure. But do you hear where I'm coming from on some of these songs?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely. I think the first two, especially like Ghost in the Mirror and Lose, the first song on the record, are both, you know, they have that quality to them.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be reductive, and that's not all I have to say about them, but it's just something that I just want to convey to you that people in my house, maybe not my daughter. My daughter has got no comment on this.
Unnamed members of your household.
My wife and my son and I have engaged in conversations about this album, and we really, really love it. And I just want you to know that. Going back to the thing we were talking about that was kind of heavy, but I think interesting.
Yeah.
By the way, have you ever read a book? Let me see if I can find it here. I usually have my internet off, but I was listening to you talk. Have you ever read a book called Dispatches from the Front, The Life of Matthew Halton, Canada's Voice at War? You ever read that book?
No.
I read that book.
I haven't.
Well, I'm echoing when I say, you know what it was actually like in terms of Canada being fully on board with what was going on in Nazi Germany. A lot of it is from my memory of reading that book because he was a war correspondent. And he said, you know, and sorry, his son helped write this book. His dad was a celebrated Canadian journalist, but he's very like, you have no idea what it was like at the time. We all are like, anti this now, but like at the time everyone didn't know what to do. And so my two questions, so I just want to mention that book, and if you want I can send you a link to it because I found it interesting. Or I can even ship my copy down to you. What the hell, I don't care, we'll figure it
all
out.
Right.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. But my point is this, two things. Your own heritage, I'm curious about your own biases or whatever in exploring this stuff. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? You've mentioned a few geopolitical players. I think we've alluded to some religious affiliations. Why are you so keen about knowing this as a Canadian, if anything else? Can you speak to that?
I mean, so my own background is German, 50% German, 50% Irish. That's it. My family, my mom and dad were the first people to marry outside of their respective ethnic, you know, enclaves here. And their parents were fairly recent immigrants to Canada.
Right.
Me, I grew up in the same kind of cultural vacuum that I think a lot of people in my generation on the West Coast grew up in. You know, like as Canadians, what are we? Who are we? You know, like some people will, you know, if you're white, I guess if you're white, right, is what I'm saying, you can go the route of, embracing your Irish roots or whatever. That didn't really seem reasonable to me. And, you know, the more I learned about Canada, I think I had a light bulb moment, you know, when I was in high school, growing up around Indigenous communities and around reservations and having Indigenous friends, I was like, oh, we're colonists, right? And that this entire country is basically like the company store. I mean, on the podcast, we would always say Canada is three mining companies in a trench coat.
Right.
and that, you know, I had a very proto version of that in my head as a teenager. And then, you know, as I got older, besides being interested in music, I've always been interested in geopolitical history and journalism in particular. And I think what really pushed me into digging into this is I got very excited back in and around, I would say, 2015, 2016. Because this story about Freeland's grandfather came out. Hey, actually, this woman who is in charge of, you know, a lot of foreign, she was, you know, she was Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Yeah, of course.
Disastrously so.
Yeah.
I started looking into, you know, also, the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine had happened. I have a lot of friends in Eastern Europe, and we were talking constantly about, like, what was going on with Maidan, you know, because it was being sold to us in Canada as some kind of glorious fucking democratic revolution that was going to liberate Ukraine from the shackles of, you know, dependence on the evil empire of Russia. And what it did do was kick off a civil war that is, you know, kind of now ongoing with Russia's invasion. Anyway, you know, I was fascinated by this. And once I started reading about the Ukrainian diaspora and this group of openly fascist ex-SS people being accepted and kind of colonizing this existing community, I was like, oh, I should, you know, somebody should write about this. So I reached out to fucking Jesse Brown on Twitter and was like, hey, do you want to, maybe you should do a story about this. Like very naively in retrospect. And at the time, one of his editors.
But Dan, for those listening around the world, and I hate to cut you off.
Okay.
Can you contextualize Jesse Brown? I'd like you to, but I think you also said in retrospect, so something's going on right as Dan and I are speaking right now. Jesse Brown, who Dan will contextualize in a moment, is kind of imploding, or empire is imploding.
His empire is imploding. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you do us all a favor and in your own words kind of contextualize this fellow?
Yeah, sure. Jesse was a journalist I know that he lived in Montreal actually in the late 90s, early 2000s. It's funny, somebody dug up, he wrote a very angry letter to the Montreal Gazette after attending a Black Ox Orchestra show at Sala Rosa. They were doing a benefit for Palestine. This would have been in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he wrote an extremely, in retrospect, telling letter about how he had family in Israel and it was, you know, anti-Semitic what they were doing. Even though, you know, that Constellation Records crew, who have always been on the right side of history about Israel-Palestine, many of them are Jewish.
Yes.
But that didn't seem to matter to Jesse. So
yes.
They weren't the right type of Jews. So
right.
Anyway, Jesse, I believe, you know, he's a journalist. He also has something to do with Bitmoji.
Yeah, he and became very wealthy as a result of his involvement. I don't know if he didn't create it. I don't know if he was an early investor, but he made a lot of money, I believe.
He made a lot of money off of Bitmoji.
Yeah.
Then he started Canada Land, which I was extremely excited about because, you know, there was and there still is like a real vacuum for leftist media in Canada.
Yeah.
There's just nothing.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, now you've got The Breach, which is pretty good. You've got David Mastriachi. Or Davide, rather. Or you've got Jeremy Appel. Like, it's in Edmonton, you know?
Yeah.
But at the time, Canada Land popped up. There wasn't a lot going on. There was Canadian Dimension, I guess. Canada Land was a little more accessible, I think, to, like, Canadian liberals.
Yeah.
It was very slick, and they did some great stuff.
Primarily in the realm of podcasting, but also a very vibrant website with articles and exposed a lot of broke a lot of news, I guess, is a way of putting
it. Broke a lot of news. Yeah. I mean, one of his favorite targets was the CBC,
which he used to work for.
Yes, yeah. And I loved to see Jesse go after the CBC. That was you know, that and the Thunder Bay podcast, which I think everybody who's listened to can agree is a really great piece of Canadian journalism.
Yeah.
Where Canada Land sucked, which I would find out after, you know, having this conversation with Jesse, is foreign policy. Hmm. For some reason, they would have the most credulous, dumbass takes on. They would have these guests on, you know, I remember they were talking about Iran and was it Kaveh Sharouz? Someone who worked for the McDonald Laurier Institute came on their podcast and was, you know, and it's just like, if you don't know anything about who this person is and you listen to them talk, you're like, oh, this guy seems to know a lot about Iran. But then you Google them and you're like, oh, they work for all these bizarre, like, USAID cutouts, or they work for a right-wing think tank that is absolutely obsessed with destroying Iran and, you know, flipping it to democracy or whatever.
Yeah, Canada has its fair share of right-wing think tanks that maybe people don't know about. Yeah.
Yeah, McDonald Laurier Institute being a big one. Yeah. I mean, and the way these things work is they come up with, you know, that they're funded by, you know, McDonald Laurier Institute, for example. If you'll remember back in the mid-2010s, there were all these stories coming out about Latvia in mainstream media, right?
Yeah.
Justin Ling wrote a bunch of them. And you know, I think he wrote some shit for Vice magazine on Latvia too. And I was always just like, why are we hearing about Latvia? Yeah. What is going on here?
Yeah.
But then if you look at McDonald Laurier Institute, for those years, one of their biggest donors was literally the Latvian Ministry of Defense. So you have another country's defense department funding a think tank whose job it is to pay journalists to tell Canadians what to think about that country.
Right.
And also to green light and get public approval for what we eventually did with Latvia, which is sending a bunch of troops there and, you know, diverting tax dollars to give them weapons and armored personnel carriers and whatever we could get away with.
Yeah.
So the Latvian Ministry of Defense really did their job.
Right.
And all of this is laundered through journalists. And those journalists and journalists like them would come on Canada Land occasionally to talk about foreign policy, which would drive me fucking nuts.
Are you speculating that the Canada Land folks knew about these affiliations?
No. Oh, okay. I think they're not at all. No. Okay. I think they're just generally clueless when it comes to foreign policy.
I see. Yeah. But you're saying you would do a Google of a guest and discover these connections at the very least.
Or you just look at their social media feed, and if it's just like, you know, okay, we have an expert on, you know, China or whatever, and then you just look at their feed and it's just a bunch of insane anti-communist shit. You know, where they're retweeting Shen Yun or something. Yeah. You know, he also, like, Jesse also had fucking Sam Cooper on, who, you know, famously, you know, whipped up this fucking witch hunt in Canadian politics, basically accusing liberal MPs of being moles for the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
And Jesse had this guy on. And you know, this is a guy who lost his job at a newspaper because his reporting was so shoddy, and someone he went after fucking sued him.
Right.
But he was invited on Canada Land as a guest to talk about geopolitics.
So Canada Land ascended because you said, Dan, there was a vacuum in, I don't know what the best way to put it, like edgy, subversive, uncompromising journalism. But as we're speaking, I alluded to the fact that Jesse's seems to be having a rough time of the world in terms of how to convey. Basically, the perception of him now is that he's a Zionist. I guess that's the shorthand. Is that a way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, much to the chagrin of, you know, his staff. So I got to say, for every bad episode of Candleland where Sam Cooper is on talking about unnamed intelligence sources. There was a good episode of Candidate Land. And to their credit, they even rebutted one of their own episodes, which is a separate episode that Jesse wasn't involved with.
Yeah.
So essentially what you've got is a bunch of young, good journalists under this umbrella. But the person at the top is now, like you said, spewing all of this really insane Zionist shit online.
Yeah.
Constantly, every day, or every other day, you know?
Yeah.
Occasionally he'll take it too far and then disappear for a little while, but like, you know.
Hey, thanks for listening to Creative Control, as always. As you may have heard me mention, I recently lost my day job, and I've had a few conversations with people since who've said, you had a day job? I thought your podcast was your day job. When I explained why it hasn't been my day job to a friend, he suggested I should share some of this information with people like you listening right now. So, in short, unless they have some giant exclusive million-dollar contract, podcasters are not paid to make stuff by companies like Apple and Spotify. Podcasters do not make any money from streaming royalties. Ad revenue is dependent on a certain threshold of downloads each month, and even if your show is accessed 30,000 times a month, the income you get is actually really minimal. So podcasters like me usually make time in our lives to support our communities and our interests to make these shows, and our most reliable source of income for this work is, in fact, crowdfunding. In my case, it's my Patreon. So if you'd like to receive ad-free episodes earlier than everyone else, regular newsletters and blog posts, bonus audio content, and support my work, quite literally, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's an interesting time for this sort of stuff where the nuances of people's affiliations aren't being considered in a fulsome way. I asked about your background because I just wanted to figure, and it sounds to me like you are, like me, a Canadian who maybe felt in the dark about the history of their country, how it was whitewashed. And I mean, German-Irish, that's an interesting combination given what we're talking about. You got a real power structure and a real a group that's been subjugated to all sorts of, who've been colonized. I mean, what the hell? So
Well, it's also Lutheran German and Irish Catholic. So there's a, you know, there's kind of a theological war.
This may
be two wolves
in you. So, but yes, we are at this point where people are like, we're not against the Jewish people. Because you mentioned Black Ox Orchestra. You mentioned Jesse writing a letter. So it's not the Jewish people. It's the Zionists. It's the Israeli Zionists we're against. I don't know if you were saying this, but it's not the Ukrainians. It's the fascist Ukrainians. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not unlike the more virulent colonizing Zionist movement in Israel, which is, you know, has a lot of structure in North America to essentially project their platform that, you know, Zionism, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, right?
Yeah.
Not unlike that, there's sort of a weird parallel with Ukraine where it's mostly, you know, leading up to Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, it was mostly Western Ukrainians. So these are people who live from Kyiv to the west, to the border of Poland, and this area is Galicia. And this is sort of the epicenter of a very specific strain of Ukrainian ethno-nationalism that was then sold to the rest of the world as just Ukrainianness.
Right. Yes.
Whereas, you know, Ukrainian identity is much, much more complicated than that and contains different ethnic subgroups, contains, because it's a post-Soviet country, contains Russians, you know? And it begs like a huge question, which is, what is it to be Ukrainian, you know?
You know, and this prompted the two lines of questioning I wanted to follow up with you about. One was about your own sort of heritage and positioning. Mm-hmm. The other was about ostensibly about corollaries to now. Because we talked about the fact that you're a Canadian living in America, and maybe 10 years ago, you would have felt a little separate or a little alienated, a little superior. And now you don't.
Maybe.
I'm putting some words in your mouth, but I just wonder about.
No, I agree.
Okay. So I want to talk about now and what's happening. I don't know if you're following. I think you probably are. You seem like a guy who's really informed. If you're following the state of Canadian affairs and politics right now and the way the far right is glomming on to tactics from the American far right and what all of this says about media literacy, because what we're talking about in the nuances of different kinds of people and the conflation of Zionism with people who are Jewish and they're not the same thing. And the Ukrainian nationalists and just Ukrainian people, there is this reliance from certain forces that this conflation and this lack of nuance will be accepted wholeheartedly. Yeah. And I think with you, people like you, and I you know, ideally people like me, we are trying to be like, I don't know if I buy any of this shit. I'm going to read up on this.
I mean, even just in my personal life, I will say I don't have a single Jewish friend who's a Zionist. I don't have a single Jewish friend who isn't wholeheartedly, full-throatedly opposing what the Netanyahu Ben-Gvir government is doing. And, you know, some of my friends are journalists or podcasters or, you know, musicians. Not a single Jewish friend of mine is a Zionist.
Right.
You know? And I wonder, you know, I sometimes when I talk to them, their personal take is that, you know, they're constantly being told that they aren't the right type of Jew.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
But by whom exactly? The Zionists.
Zionists.
Right.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's, and you know, I've encountered this on this show. I haven't been able to really delve into this with people because I think people are afraid to talk about it. And it's an awkward thing to bring up in the midst of an album promotional, you know, whatever. Like, how are we going to talk about this? From your own perspective, I don't know. Like, do you feel like it's, these are easy subjects to be outspoken about these days?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, when after October 7th, you know, I felt the initial wave of press and sort of in my own industry, the reaction around it, you know, Warner Brothers, Sony putting out these bizarre statements on Instagram saying, you know, we stand with the Netanyahu government. We stand with Israel. It's just like, well, wait a minute. You know, yeah, this is a tragedy, but requires not really a lot of reading to figure out context for.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, myself, like I've been involved in one way or another with the Palestinian struggle for, you know, independence and autonomy since I became politically aware. You know, I've attended marches. I have tried to educate myself as much as possible. I've made friends with Palestinian people and listened to their stories and tried to learn, you know?
Yeah.
It's not hard to do.
But then, there was this knee-jerk reaction to align people. People were aligning themselves with Israel like right away because of how the terrorist attack was framed. And
now they're walking it, a lot of people are walking it back because you can't, you know, you can't wake up every day and see the big ticker go up and up for dead women and children in Gaza.
And,
you know,
and men.
The mind recoils, right? Yeah. Like if you have any scrap of human decency, you cannot look at that and say, well, they deserve it. or, well, you know, the Israelis have a right to self-defense, you know, or the Israelis have a right to, you know, like massacre 100 people if it means one Hamas person gets whacked, you know, like it just, as a moral person, you can't take that stance, no matter how you are politically aligned.
Yeah, we are in this, I don't mean to conflate this genocide with domestic political tricks, but I do feel like we're constantly confronted by the truth and it's obfuscated, or we're told to not trust it. And when I talk about media literacy, that's what I'm getting at.
Right.
When you see a country going after hospitals and universities to supposedly neutralize terrorists and destroy a whole civilization, and you're told it's self-defense, ideally, your brain would say, wait a minute, that can't be true. And then what do we do about this situation? All my friends or whatever, everyone I see on Twitter or everywhere is supporting Israel. And then if you don't support Israel, you're viewed as anti-Semitic. How the hell is this going to work? Like, and again, I want to go back to what I was saying about American-style politics entering Canada as well. I don't know if you have observed this, but this same kind of obfuscation is a bullshit word. Lying. Just outright, like no holes barred lying like I've never seen. Yes. And a certain member, a certain percentage, a higher than normal percentage of the populace being like, I believe the lie. I choose to believe the lie. The horror is too catastrophic. Like I can't deal with the horror. So I'm take what happened
with the fucking SS officer that got a standing ovation. Honka. You know, it happened. Basically, the speech before the standing ovation was, this guy fought the Soviets in World War II. If you have like a child's understanding of World War II, you know what that means.
Yes.
Who is fighting the Soviets?
The Nazis.
The fucking Nazis.
So
he gets a standing ovation. Everybody kind of plays dumb. They got to pin it on somebody. And I don't know if you remember, but they pinned it on the Speaker of the House.
Yes.
And then it came out, oh, Trudeau knew about it.
Well, there was speculation that the Conservatives knew about it too, that Paul Revere knew about it too. Like they all knew about it.
They all knew.
Yeah.
They just don't care, you know?
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, they can just lie and then nothing happens. It really does feel, I mean, to pull back a little bit, it does feel like the gears of liberal democracy are grinding to a halt. Like in Canada and especially in America. I mean, this election coming up is a fucking farce. Like Biden can barely string a thought together.
Yeah.
Kamala is benzoed out of her fucking mind.
Yep.
Even Trump doesn't have the poisonous juice that he had in 2016.
Well, they're both... He's incoherent.
Old and tired.
He's completely incoherent and I think has some sort of aphasia or something. Something's not right there either. And it is a really dark and gloomy time. Let's get to your record.
Let's go.
Because as I ponder... the amazing performances on it. Man, the drumming. That's Matt Chamberlain, right? The drumming?
That is the one and only Matt Chamberlain.
You know,
former drummer for Bob Dylan, Saturday Night Live band, David Bowie. Also played on Fetch the Bolt Cutters, which is an incredible performance of drums and percussion. Like, yeah, I was amazing to get to work with him.
Yeah, remarkable and upbeat in a lot of ways, arrangement-wise. But as I ponder the lyrics, I'm not going to suggest that they reflect anything we were just talking about, but I do sense a bit of pessimism, maybe a little bit here and there. Certainly, I feel like mortality is on your mind. What the future might look like. Is any of this resonating with you?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean... I think honestly, having the podcast allowed me to make this record a lot more personal. You know, a lot of these songs are very personal, and in that way, it's more like I think it's more like the first Wolf Parade record than anything I've done since. I had like an outlet for some of the more political stuff that, say, when Handsome Furs was happening, I was addressing directly in songs, but this is a little more personal. But it's always there, I think, in my writing.
Yeah. So the record and the project, I suppose, the project is called Beckner.
Yes.
It's not, by the way, everyone, it's not Dan Beckner, the guy's Beckner. Name. It's just Beckner. That suggests an assertion of oneself into the proceedings. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, it does come across as very personal and potentially reflective. Do you have a sense of what spurred these notions on? One, I'm going to assert myself. I'm going to name this after me. And my last name, by the way, that's almost familial, mm-hmm. You know, your surname, connecting yourself to your family heritage, I think. And then, yeah, just actually reflecting, I think, a bit more upon your life and certain people. Do you know what spurred this on?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going through a massive life change on every conceivable level. And it was really Jonathan Poneman at Sub Pop who encouraged me. You know, I was like, I have this collection of songs, I don't know what to do with it. And he was like, you should just keep writing, and you should call this, should be your name. And essentially, you know, just drawing a line between this point in my career and the before times. And the line is, if I'm not writing with Wolf Parade, it's going to be this. I'm not starting another band or multiple bands. Everything from here on out is under my name. And the record itself is really, this might sound pretentious, but like, I think the last 20 years I've been trying to, everybody who plays music is always usually trying to develop their own language, you know, musically, their own voice. And I think this record just draws all the different strands together, like the electronic stuff that I started working on with Handsome Furs and then continued through Operators, all of the guitar stuff through Wolf Parade, through Divine Fits, to draw all these things together and make a record that is kind of me.
I want to talk about that line for a moment because I think you may have alluded to it, and I don't want to get too personal, but when you say you were enduring massive life changes, that to me sounds like the root of where we're at with this record. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you just did it, you were like, yeah, this is all of my modes of expression tied in one record, finally, after 20 years.
Yeah.
So can we go back again? I don't mean to pry, and obviously people are listening, but can you talk a little bit more, elaborate upon those life changes and why they might have spurred this on?
I think just getting older, watching, you know, living, this record is not inspired by the pandemic in any way, you know, it would have happened with or without the pandemic, but I think the massive acceleration after the world was declared open for business, I think everybody felt that. It wasn't so much for me the staying at home or the fear of disease or watching bodies pile up at morgues on television. It was everything being declared fine. I naively maybe assumed that things would get better after a collective trauma that was shared by every country on the planet. But instead, it seemed like all of the sort of worst impulses of capitalism had been kind of building up and bottlenecked and then were just fucking unleashed. And I mean on every level. The housing market did not cool out. It got worse. Commodities. Companies decided, we can actually charge anyone whatever we want, and there's nothing anyone will do to stop us.
We can also give people less stuff and still charge them the same, if not more. Yeah.
Exactly. At least in the West. I mean, I'm just talking about the collective West here. I'm not talking about Africa or China or, you know, Central Asia or any of those countries who had a very different response to the pandemic and to the post-pandemic sort of new world order of economics. So I think that, you know, that was a big shared fracture. And my response to it was to, you know, basically have a psychological meltdown. So,
you know, I tried to encapsulate where I thought this record was coming from. And I think I did a kind of a clumsy job. But I do think you illuminated it further for me. I think I was hinting at despair, but I think there's a distinction between despair and disillusionment. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing I will tell you, Dan, personally. First of all, you're not alone in exactly what you're feeling. If I'm on the right track, I'm going through this. And when I talk about it on the show or with people, I think other people think I'm a huge bummer for being like, I don't know. Like, we all went through a thing and it didn't change anything.
Yeah.
Like, we all of us who have been sort of quietly participating in, or rather quietly criticizing capitalism while full-throatedly participating in it because we need to live, and that's what we have to work with. You know, I think in the early days of the pandemic, I was like, this is good. This has to foster change.
Yeah.
This has to alter our relationship to medical care. This has to alter our relationship to, you know, polluting the environment. Remember those early days where, like, you could see the sky and everything was great? And now,
you could hear the birds.
Now we're being told if you call 911, you may not get anyone coming by.
This is right. So basically, you know, I thought that if anything was going to shove our sort of neoliberal order towards more the state having more responsibility for the health and well-being and just fucking survival of its citizens, it would be this, and it had the opposite effect.
The opposite. It's not even like, you're being too cynical and critical and expecting too much. It literally had the opposite effect. So when I talk about mortality, there's like, you have songs where like, you're not, it's a bit dark, Dan. I mean, some of your lyrics here concern me, like wondering if there's even, you know, going to be a tomorrow. I don't take that as like, we're all going to die. I worry about the writer, the composer saying, I'm not even paying attention to the days of the week because I don't even care. You know?
Yeah.
That's the state you were in?
That was pretty much the state that I was in. I mean, when I wrote those songs. Yeah. Yeah. And I needed, and I will say, I don't think the record is depressing and it doesn't wallow in depression because I rewrote a lot of those songs. I demoed them. I recorded bed tracks and then I went in and just, I came out of this pit feeling better. And actually, if you don't mind, I want to read, you know, we're talking about despair. It reminded me, I want to read something that my friend Matt Crispin wrote.
Sure.
Matt was one of the hosts of Chapo Trap House, but he also has a incredible YouTube channel where he talks about these themes that we're talking about. And the subject is hope. So Matt also suffered a massive medical event, you know, in the last couple of months and is recovering.
I've been following that, and I know they haven't divulged all of the details. Like, I was seeing reports from his wife because, for those who don't know, this ostensibly coincided with he and his wife having a baby. And all my best to him and his family. I have no, but they, I'm right, Dan, they haven't actually revealed what the medical.
No, not to, not publicly, but you know, I'm friends with him and, you know, those, that crew and I met.
Have you communicated? Has he been able to communicate with anyone?
Yeah, I've spoken to him a couple of times and,
okay.
But, you know, just over text, but this is for Matt and this really, like, I read this, you know, every month, but it's about hope. So Matt says, we can't know what's going to happen. We rescue ourselves partially from despair by approaching politics through that lens while also cultivating love for those around us and for the universe, offloading our ego and emotional connection to other things and other people and animals and everything, and embracing the eternal flipping coins that make up the world that we're moving through. It is about creating a path, a tunnel, a target, a hologram of the world to live in and orient yourself in, and creating a power source to drive yourself forward. And I believe in that, you know, that being surrounded by so much despair and just being mind-boggled by the seemingly fathomless cruelty that our government and other governments wreak upon their citizenry, it is good to make a tunnel, you know,
for 100%.
Yourself. It's good. Yeah. It's good to make a tunnel. It's good to embrace hope, even surrounded by all of this despair. And I hope that comes out in the record, you know.
It absolutely does. I was trying to juxtapose some of the lyrics I read with the sound of the record and the propulsive performances of, like, it's a fantastically uplifting record in that regard. It's just when I tend to home in on what people are saying and when I hear certain things, it catches my ear and gives me a little like, uh-oh, I'm a little concerned about Dan. You know what I mean? But I just want to say, like, I've had the same feelings and thoughts. And I have people like you on the show because you create hopeful things for me.
Thank you.
And for fans, you know, like you, this is why I didn't have Dan on to depress everyone. That's my point. I think the record. Yeah.
I don't think, you know, I think it should be cathartic. You know, I've made on the spectrum of depressing records or, you know, and some of my contributions to Wolf Parade, I'd say this is some of the least depressing stuff that I've done.
It sounds like someone who has climbed out of a pit, if I may. Like, it does sound you're hopeful. So you mentioned that this is the most Wolf Parade-like record you've made since the first Wolf Parade record. Is that
I think the songwriting is, the way I wrote the songs was closer to apologies than anything else. You know, I wrote them from a very personal standpoint. As Wolf Parade went on, I would, you know, my writing style would be to abstract things more and more, you know, almost as if, you know, especially with Handsome Furs, almost as if I was writing like a science fiction book to talk about actual human feelings that I had. You know?
Yeah.
But I think this is more of a return to personal songwriting.
Do you suppose, or rather, did you ever suppose, like, maybe I'll save some of this for the next Wolf Parade record if we make one? Did you ever think that?
No, I mean, I know that Wolf Parade's going to make more music together. I just, you know, I'm not sure how or when that's going to happen. I'm sure in the next few years there'll be new Wolf Parade songs. But with this, I was like, I have spent so much of my career compartmentalizing my writing, you know, like, I think at the peak, I was just like, okay, is this a Handsome Furs song? Am I contributing this to another band? Is it a Wolf Parade song? And I could always kind of sort those blocks. But with this, I was like, okay, anything I write right now is going into this soup.
Yeah. When you sing of love and romance on this record, is this, and again, you know, I'm sort of presupposing this is your own voice. It's not narrative. It sounds like it is, actually. You're saying it's very personal. So I'm going to forego the notion that you're adopting full-on narrative voices when you employ I or you. I'm going to say now that I've talked to you, I'm going to picture you in these conversations. Is this a composite of relationships you've had that you're reflecting upon?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. So definitely.
The principals involved might be able to be like, I think he's talking about me.
Yes. I mean, I think so, if they listen to it.
Yeah. So does this give you pause in terms of your own behavior in relationships? Like, do you come out of a writing process like this one and being like, what did I learn about myself here? I'm kind of like this, or I was. I'm glad I'm not like that anymore. Like, do you have these kinds of ruminations?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I am. Yeah. Yeah, I am glad, you know, some of the versions of me in those songs, I am glad I'm not like that anymore. But writing about it is a way to purge it, you know, I think.
Are they vaguely apologetic, would you say?
No, I don't think so.
they're stock taking. You're acknowledging it, but it's just like, is a catch-all way of saying it. On many of these songs, this is who you were as opposed to who you are?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these songs, the me in these songs is decidedly in the rear view, you know, and for good reason. So,
but I don't mean to get too back to the future-y about this in terms of time travel, but I do think that when someone in the present moment ponders who they are, who they were in any kind of castigating way, that's a sign of growth for who they are now.
I mean, you would hope so, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I I do believe that you're constantly in a process of recombining, like, your, I mean, personality matrix, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's always some kind of core that's never going to change. But the things that orbit around it, behaviors and the way you perceive people you love, the way you treat people you love, they're constantly changing. Or at least they should be. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. They should be. They should be assessed, you know?
Given the self-reflection we've been talking about, would you say a song like Dead Tourists is an anomaly on this record? That's one where I'm like, this feels more like a narrative. I don't.
Yeah, that's the only one, really. Yeah. That's not... But I still very much identify with the protagonist in that song. That was a co-write that I did with Jeremy from Kiwi Jr. So,
oh, nice.
I produced Kiwi Jr.'s last record, Chopper. It was the first record I ever produced that wasn't my own. And it was so much fun. It was
like, just so you know, Dan, I think all the boys, maybe someone was missing, but we all had a nice chat about you and that making that record. Kiwi Jr., we have a bit of a tradition since their first record. They all come on the show. The first time I went and met them in person in Toronto, in some mansion they were renting or something. I don't know what the hell was going on in there. And then subsequently, almost all of them joined me for conversations. Anyway, we spoke very highly and lovingly of you. I, from my perspective, they from working with you. So just so you know, it's a mutual admiration society, if I may.
I love that band. I think they're, as a band, they work so well together. They're like, basically everything fits, you know, they just have this telepathic communication. And Jeremy's lyrics are fantastic. Like,
yeah,
he is, in a lot of ways. I mean, I know the songs are much catchier than The Fall, but especially on Chopper, like, the characters he chooses to focus on are not unlike Marky Smith focusing on these small town characters. Like the downtown area band song, the personal injury lawyer being stuck in a fucking storage. It's so good, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very Toronto and it's very, very good. So
this collab came about you knowing you were going to make a solo record, or was it something that you'd started working on for that session, the Kiwi session?
It was specifically for this solo record.
How did you, I assume you weren't in the same room together working on this?
No, I was basically living at the studio in New York where I was recording this record, which is, you know, this it's an amazing studio in a crumbling like 18th century warehouse on the edge of East Williamsburg.
That sounds familiar. That's like where Shahzad, Ismaili, and some people kind of are, I think, or were.
Yeah. The same zone. Randall Dunn, the guy that produced the record and was instrumental in putting together the band, which, you know, is mainly Matt Chamberlain and Brad Lehner from Medicine. He has a studio there. So it's his studio. I was sleeping above the keyboard loft. There are no windows except for a skylight. And the other person in the studio is Daniel, One O'Trix Point Never.
Oh, okay.
So I basically got to hear him making his entire new record and the soundtrack for The Curse.
Oh, nice. That's an amazing soundtrack. Holy shit.
So all of this was happening at the same time, basically. Like, The Curse soundtrack was being mixed and recorded. You know, Daniel was working on his new album, feeding MIDI into bizarre AI strings. And I was writing these songs and recording them. And that's, you know, during that time, Jeremy sent me like a keyboard version of Dead Tourist, which we then kind of worked up into its current form. I think I had to move the key so I could sing it. And then we played around with the lyrics. And there's an Easter egg in that song that I'm very proud of. So
there's some things that confuse me. They say our Michaels are just out of luck. That confused me, and I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that's the Easter egg.
So let's leave it and let people try to figure this out. I don't know what that means, but it's...
Okay. Well, I'll just say, regarding the Michaels, there are two of them.
They say our Michaels are just
two
out of luck.
Two Michaels.
Okay.
Two beautiful, innocent Michaels.
Okay. And it's...
Who would never sue each other in court over who... is a spy.
And okay. I think we've got more Easter egg action out of this than I expected. Okay, yeah. I appreciate that. But that song, though, what can you? I appreciate that you and Jeremy were going through. But Dead Tourist is an interesting image, and I don't want to let this go because this stands out for me. Where did that imagery even come from?
I don't know. I mean, Jeremy kicked off the writing process, and we, you know, the song itself is really about a guy who dies on vacation at some. It's never fully described, but you know, I always imagined the setting to be one of the lesser resorts, you know, like just a crappy beach town, and he dies, but he doesn't know he's dead, and he's just basically haunting this place.
It's really weird. May I just read the opening two lines for the people who don't know what we're talking about? The song is called Dead Tourist. The opening lines are, "Dead tourist at the window looking for his holiday. Vancouver on a work week hit me in my office, babe."
Yes.
What the hell is that? What does that mean? Well, Vancouver, I automatically thought of your BC roots, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I was like, Vancouver on a work week. That's a germ. Is this Jeremy? Is some of the Jeremy's in here somewhere? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I don't know. Yeah. It's like both evocative and I can picture it all, but I don't know what it means. It's perfect. I like that. I like what it's doing to me, but I don't know what it means. I don't know that you're going to illuminate it any further, but there's something about
the. I do really love the detail in this song where there's a beer named after this guy.
Yes, that's right. The name, like, the Dead Tourist.
Namesake's the local beer.
What? Yeah. How the hell? What? Okay, there's just a lot going on here, and I don't know what it means, but it's an alluring song. Anyway, Dan, I just want to say, there's a lot of fascinating aspects to your album, and it's great. It is upbeat, and I can't wait to get a physical copy of it and study it and hold it in my hands, because I said that to my wife. I'm going to get me one of these. It's not always the case, you know. They send me these things digitally, and I just am like, yeah, maybe I'll get it. Getting this one.
I could get you a physical copy. The vinyl's going to be nice. It's orange, I believe.
Oh.
A nice, clear orange vinyl, Halloween colors.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm not fishing here. I wasn't asking for merch. I just want to say I'm going to get
one. I know, but you should get a copy of the record.
Okay. So. It's really brilliant, and I'm just mindful of our time. So I hope we've got, did we get to the record enough? I know we spent 45 minutes talking about the Ukraine.
Yeah. I guess we talked a lot about Canadian politics. I mean, I got to say, like, I'm very proud of this album, and I was extremely lucky to be able to work with Matt, to be able to work with Randall, to have Heba Kadri master it. She's done mastering for incredible albums like Björk, you know. She really elevated the album, I think. And yeah, Brad Lehner, who I grew up listening to Medicine, much sort of underappreciated American shoegaze band. Brad does something with guitars that I don't think anyone else has even approached. And, you know, you want to talk about building your own musical language. This guy started as a, you know, one of the first like industrial music guys with playing as a teenager in Savage Republic, another great band, and then unleashing Medicine on the world. So to be able to write with him, and he played a lot of the lead guitar stuff, or we doubled each other, and that was, I mean, he's also coming on tour with me, so
great.
Guess I should talk about the tour.
Yeah. You've got tour dates coming up. I saw that. But I don't want to leave Matt out of this either. I know we alluded to him earlier, but I have a soft spot for Matt, Dan, because I'm a massive Bob Dylan fan. And I know Matt plays on Rough and Rowdy Ways and was in the live band for a bit. I just saw Mr. Dylan three times in the fall, and Matt wasn't there, obviously. But his playing on this is... Go ahead.
Matt's out with Diana Krall right now.
Yes.
And I believe it's Diana Krall, Mark Ribot, Matt, and someone else. And Matt actually, in a bizarre twist of fate, speaking of Bob Dylan, lives up the street from me. So,
In New Orleans.
So he's been splitting his time between here and there. And post-recording this record, we actually went into a small studio here in New Orleans where the metal band Thou, who are also New Orleans natives, record. And Matt and I recorded 60 minutes of insane krautrock drums and synth. So,
oh, cool.
I was like, we're going to keep just writing and recording together, because I mean, it's just a joy to play with him, you know?
Two things I'll say real quick. When I saw Bob Dylan at Massey Hall over two nights, you know who was in the audience and right near me? Elvis Costello and Diana Krall.
So well, there you go.
That's a weird connection. And then I will just, there's lots of great, as someone who has tried to play drums for most of my life, it seems, I will say I'm really mesmerized by his playing. And there's a roll or fill in Lose that makes no sense. It makes no sense when I hear it. And I'm just like, what the fuck? And it brings, everything falls back into place. And it's just very unexpected. Just great playing, if I might say.
It's so that fill is right before the end.
Yeah.
Coda, you know, there's a bass synth melody that sort of starts riding over everything. I would call that melody very Wolf Parade-ian and whimsical.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So not quite full circus, but almost. and Matt, you know, my original demo of that song is extremely sequenced. It's, you know, sequenced drum, sequenced bass. And I don't know how he did it, but Matt handed in that fill and it somehow time stretched.
Yeah.
Like we didn't do time stretching, but his playing against the very rigid sequencing somehow elongated time in that moment. It doesn't make any sense, but it totally works.
Yeah. I hate to just pick one moment, but that one sticks out for me. It's the first song on the album for those who haven't heard it yet. And look out for it. It's something else, I will say. It's like, what the hell was that?
It's wild.
Yeah. It is. So we're at the stage of the show, Dan. I'm going to ask you, so at the plug stage, I'm going to ask you to tell us where we can learn more about you on the internet. And I'm going to ask you what your future plans are. You've alluded to Wolf Parade potentially doing stuff at some point or whatever that means. You don't know why or what, but that's good. I'm curious about the tour, any other writing you're doing, any other activities you want to share?
Yeah. You know, I'm, let's see, where can people find me? You can find me on Twitter, Instagram. I'm apparently on TikTok, but I still don't, you know, like fully. I feel like I want to die every time I go on there. It makes me feel like offing myself.
Don't say that. Don't joke about that. Don't say that.
I'm not joking. Yeah. But let's say this. It makes me feel like I want to lay down and go to sleep for a while.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But I, you know, whatever, respect is just not for me.
Sure.
But Twitter also terrible right now. Just awful.
It is the worst it's ever been, but we're hanging in there, some of us.
We're hanging on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm there. I'm on Instagram. I have a Patreon, you know, that I have been using to supplement the new economic reality of being a touring musician.
Yep.
So, and I also really like doing the Patreon. You know, I put out covers that I record on my 4-track. Sometimes I do a little podcasting. Sometimes I do a mixtape. So there's that. In terms of the tour, I have a West Coast tour in April. Dates are up on Sub Pop's website. And then the East Coast will be June. I will be playing in Toronto. I will be playing at the Horseshoe.
Really?
I will. Yes, and I will be donating some proceeds of that show to relief in Gaza. So,
just for context, Dan, for those who don't know, past guests on this show, LOL, band from the Toronto, had set up a show at the Horseshoe some months ago, as we're speaking, and it was a benefit for Palestinian Relief, I believe, and the owner of the Horseshoe, Jeff Cohen, canceled the show and sent them a terrible email, is from what I can tell. I don't know all the facts here except for what I'm saying to you. And
I saw the email.
Yeah.
I saw it.
It's quite, quite gross.
That whole thing.
Quite gross.
I think Jeff is barely involved with the Horseshoe at this point, as what I've heard. But
yeah, I understand he's not involved in collective concerts as much.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Yes, right. So,
allegedly.
So this is an interesting moral dilemma for you, I'm sure. You're in a situation where the Horseshoe is one of the most prominent venues in Toronto, certainly one of the most famous venues in the world, frankly, or at least Canadians like to think so. What do you do when you see that come up in your itinerary?
I talk to my booking agent, and you know, my position is that I will play the show, and I will be using money from the show to donate to people who are under siege in Gaza. And if anyone involved with putting the show on or working the show or anyone who happens to own the building doesn't like it, then they can fucking publicly cancel it.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Well, they're more than welcome to.
Yeah.
I'll play somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. So if people want to learn more about your tour dates and whatnot, You said all your social media things, basically, and your do you have a website going these days?
I don't. I don't have a website for the solo stuff. I don't.
Okay.
I'm just on social media and Sub Pop, basically, and the Patreon. But
I'll link to those things just so people can click on them. Hey, can I indulge you in one quick thing? Speaking of your Patreon, I actually had a question from someone for you specifically from my Patreon. And I don't. Okay. I didn't ask him if I can name him, but I'm going to. His name is Andrew Fetter. I did a call. I said, hey, I'll be talking to Dan. Anybody got any questions?
Yeah.
Here's the question. I hope you can feel it, Dan. Could you ask about Divine Fits? I've always hoped there would someday be another record from that collaboration. Again, that's from my Patreon supporter, Andrew Fetter. Dan, can you speak to that?
Yeah. You know, I talk to Britt very frequently, and we always talk about doing another Divine Fits record. So I would say, yes, it's going to happen, but I just don't know when.
Okay.
But Divine Fits will rise again. And to that end, you know, I got to talk a little bit more about the tour. The West Coast dates, I'll be backed up. The band will be Sam Brown, who is the drummer for Divine Fits and Operators, and Alex Fischel, who's the keyboard player for Divine Fits and Spoon.
Oh, nice.
And Brad Lehner. So that'll be the band.
Nice.
And we're essentially what we're going to do is we're going to play the whole album. But, you know, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, I really feel like this project is to kind of collect up like a 20 plus year career.
Hmm.
So I figured it would be nice to play Wolf Parade and Handsome Furs and Divine Fits songs. So we'll be playing catalog stuff as
well. Oh, okay, cool.
So we're gonna play a bunch of Wolf Parade, a bunch of Handsome Furs, and a bunch of Divine Fits tunes.
That's
not a bunch of Divine Fits tunes, but you know,
some
three, some
yeah,
so yeah.
That's cool. Britt and Alex from Spoon were on this show in 2022. And Britt's really
right.
Sweet. We exchanged some emails. I tried to connect Britt to the people at the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa. I promised on the show that if they were ever in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I could get them in on a tour. And I don't remember if the timing worked out, but I made my arrangements and I can't remember if they actually made it. But anyway, yeah, it's just a small world is all I'm getting at, Dan.
It is.
We know some of the same people, and it's nice. Anyway, thank you, Andrew, for your question. Thank you, Dan, for fielding it. I almost said Dan Fielding. You ever watch Night Court?
Love Night Court.
Yeah, I do, too. Yeah. It's one of the only shows I can't find on anything, like all the streaming services. Okay, it's not on there. Cheers. Everything else is on there. I can't find...
It's like it's been scrubbed from existence somehow.
Yeah, I haven't watched the new one.
It's the TV show they don't want you to see.
Maybe not. Know? Maybe not, actually. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going on one of my tangents here. Okay, we've covered all these things. I want to go out on a... Oh, and sorry, you're in Arcade Fire? What's going on there? You mentioned that as well.
Yeah, I replaced Will Butler in Arcade Fire. Will stepped away from the band, and I am now playing synths, have been playing synths and guitar and, you know, in the band for the last couple of years.
So you're a member. You're not an auxiliary member or whatever.
No, I am in the band.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You join the band, all this shit comes out. How are you dealing with that?
Yeah.
How do you reconcile that?
You know, it was really one day at a time on tour. And it was pretty impressive to see the band do internal accountability, you know, and be very open with each other about that. I was impressed, I gotta say, you know, and the band itself is, you know, more than one person or the sum of its part. It's bigger than the sum of its parts, I would say, you know.
Okay, so you're an active, you contribute ideas, you contribute, you're a collaborator at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and is there activity there, touring or anything?
We've got some shows coming up in Europe soon. We're doing some funeral 20th anniversary shows. And we're also doing Lollapalooza South America starting next week. So I'll be in South America while my solo record gets released, which is going to make doing interviews and stuff kind of interesting. But, you know.
Well, for what it's worth, this will be out before then. And everyone knows that being on my show is the ticket. It's a golden ticket. Everyone's going to find out about this record. No, I'm just kidding. But I thank you for making time for me and for being back on the show, Dan. If we can go out on a song from Bechner, which as we're speaking is not out yet, but as people are hearing this, will be out in just a matter of days. If not tomorrow. Can you pick a song for us to go out on and tell us why it came to mind?
Yeah, I think we could go out on Holy Is the Night, which is the last song on the record and is a song that, you know, in my life, writing songs, there are kind of two different kinds of songs for me. There are songs that just appear fully formed, and then there are songs that I have to take into the garage and work on, you know, like you would work on a table.
Yeah.
And Holy Is the Night, I would say, what are some other songs that have happened like this? This Heart's on Fire is another song like that for me. Radio Kaliningrad. Those songs appeared fully formed, seemingly by magic, and this one did as well. So I'm really proud of this song. Yeah, that's all I got to say about it.
One quick follow-up question, because you said pandemic or no, you know, these songs, this album wasn't influenced by that.
Yeah.
Let's look at the first verse for just a moment. How many days left here before us? After the plague, nothing but blue skies, there must be a trick to living that we've both forgotten. You also, I think, earlier invoked the fact that I think you invoked dystopia in some capacity, and I'm blanking on how you did, but this feels a little like that, a little dystopian. Yeah. And we have been willy-nilly throwing out the term plague to describe our moment with a pandemic in this contemporary time. Is this one not connected to what we've been going through?
Definitely. I mean, this one is about the end of it, you know.
Okay.
It itself, but the reopening, the release back into the world, you know.
Okay. For better or for worse.
Yeah, in this case, worse, but yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's hear it now. This is a brilliant song called Holy Is the Night from this new album by Bechner, which is called Bechner!
With an exclamation point.
That's why my voice went up with Bechner!
That's good.
This is Dan Bechner, but the album is Bechner! And this is Holy Is the Night. Dan, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for fielding some questions from me and giving me a lot to think about. And being so outspoken and frank, I appreciate it. So thank you, and I hope we talk soon, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
Taking the train.
Hey, you did it. You listened to almost all of this episode featuring Dan Bechner. Dan, thank you so much for appearing on this, the 846th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network. And it's available just about wherever all of you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter and learn other stuff, please visit vishkana.com. You can follow me on various social media platforms. There's a Linktree link in the show notes. It says follow Vish online. So if you want to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky, Threads, YouTube, whatever. I don't know. There's lots of other things. Oh, and if you want to pick your podcast player, there's lots of things there in that Linktree. So please click on that and follow me there. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep me and this podcast going. As you have probably heard by now, I do rely on this Patreon for my livelihood at the moment. And what do you get if you subscribe to the show on Patreon? Well, you get ad-free episodes, completely ad-free. You get them earlier than everybody else, sometimes by a lot, sometimes by the skin of my teeth. I'm getting these episodes out still. Just before midnight. But yeah, you get them earlier than everybody else. And like I say, they're ad-free. You get bonus content at certain tiers. At the $10 a month tier, you access a tier to win a prize, to enter a draw to win a prize. We do monthly draws now. And as I'm speaking to you, thanks to the people at Constellation Records, we're giving away some fine albums by the Constellation Records crew. So yeah, there's lots of stuff. And long and the short of it is, if you subscribe to the show on Patreon and become a donor, then you're supporting me and my work. And right now, I need it. So, I mean, I guess I've always needed it, but no, seriously, right now I really need it. So thank you. If you can, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol and make your flexible monthly donation today. Also want to thank Blackbird Music, wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta. You can learn more about them and order records right from their website there at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for Creative Control. Thanks to Jim Guthrie for lending me some music that I use on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Bechner, Dan Bechner, and for subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends all about it. Check out this new album by Bechner. It's called Bechner. It's out on Sub Pop, and it's great. And I hope you enjoyed the songs you got to hear, little bits and a whole one there. And that's it. I will talk to you really soon. Be well. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.